Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we also shine light ahead of us onto the path where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together, and to address problems rather than defend positions. There's another purpose too, and that is to provide a context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. We're living in what Thomas Paine would have called soul-trying times, when we're not just divided into two opposing political factions, but two separate realities. We have a president, can you hear the quote marks around that word? Who, like all the nefarious demagogues in history, is insisting that the press is the enemy, and he's looking to establish and then enforce his version of reality as the official reality. Meanwhile, on the other side, we have angry protesters, women rising, and what seems to be a war between the masculine and the feminine, tearing our souls and our essence apart. Seemingly hopeless, and yet our guest today on Wiki Politiki is offering a new definition of hope, a hopeful definition, and a way of turning fear into what she calls bold humility. Frances Moore LePay has been a leading luminary and solutionary ever since her best-selling book, Diet for a Small Planet, was published in 1971, a book Smithsonian called, quote, one of the most influential political tracts of the times. Her 19th book, we'll be talking more about this today, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want, which is co-authored with Adam Eichen, extends concrete hope to those who feel politically hopeless and helpless. Her writings have appeared in O, the Oprah magazine, Harper's, New York Times, LA Times, The Nation, People, and more. She is contributing editor at Yes magazine and its Solutions Journal. Her blogs have appeared in Huffington Post, Alternet, Common Dreams, and more. Frances currently leads the Small Planet Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, founded in 2002 with her daughter, Anna LePay. The two also co-founded the Small Planet Fund. Welcome, Frances, or as I prefer calling you, Frankie, since we'll be a little less formal. Hi, Frankie.
Thank you, Steve, and I will not call you Stevie, okay?
Hello?
That was a joke.
Oh, okay.
Can you
yes,
hear
exactly.
Me?
I can hear you. I can hear you perfectly. Everybody can as well. Now,
okay,
we first met at a conference in Dubrovnik, Croatia in 2007, thanks to Georgia Kelly's Praxis Peace Institute. I remember us crammed into a small studio there to be guests on Tom Hartman's radio broadcast back to the States. And at the time, we were at the tail end of the Bush-Cheney administration. Obama was barely on the radar, and the 2008 campaign, which we all remember, was about hope. And so we have 8 years of Obama, and now this. So let's begin where we are. Where are we now? What is this new hope, and what are the encouraging signs that you see?
Well, the most life-changing for me occurred in April of 2016, but I want to back up before I'll keep you on the edge of your seat about that. just a little bit and say that soon after I wrote Diet for a Small Planet as a 26-year-old, it came out when I was 27. Soon after, I began to say to audiences, wait a minute, hunger is not caused by scarcity of food. That's even more true today. It is caused by scarcity of democracy. And I could feel in my audiences, okay, lady, tell us, what is this democracy you're talking about, you know? And in some ways, I've been all these decades trying to figure that out. I've been in one river, so to speak, with two currents, the democracy and food. And in 2015, however, I made a pledge to the universe that I would stay with this underlying question of what is the root, and that is how we make decisions together, and therefore the root is democracy. And at that moment, or soon after that, I ended up, you know, Woody Allen tells us 90% of life is showing up. So I showed up at the first global conference on money and politics in Mexico City. And there in the rain, I met a then 22-year-old, Adam Eichen. And that became a friendship that then became a journey together. And that takes me to April of 2016, where I began answering your simple question. And that was that I participated in something called Democracy Spring. It was really my first taste of that moment when I said, oh my, I am not alone. There is a democracy movement, people who understand that we have to go to the roots of how we make decisions together and make those democratic, fair, inclusive. And so I marched over 100 miles, and I didn't think I could walk 10 miles, to tell you the truth. So it was life-changing for so many reasons, but I'll just end my answer here with one metaphor that my daughter and I came up with when we were writing our book together called Hope's Edge. And we said, you know what? Most people feel not like they're drops in the bucket, but they feel like they're drops in the Sahara, that they just evaporate before they hit the bucket, hit anything, hit the sand. But we said to each other, wait a minute, buckets fill up pretty fast on a rainy night. The problem is we feel so alone. We don't feel like we're part of shaping and filling something powerful. And so it was that moment where I was walking and walking with people I would never meet otherwise, who shared this deep passion for democracy, that I realized my steps were filling up something important. This was the democracy movement. And I could see the bucket, going back to that metaphor. So I think that was really a key moment for me that then fed this idea that hope is not what we seek out in evidence, but what we become together in action.
Yes, it's really interesting that, of course, you're finding teammates in these times. And, you know, it's not necessarily what you're going to hear on the news. What the news is about is really a lot more of the deconstructing caterpillar than the emerging butterfly. So hopefully today in our conversation, there'll be, even though it really isn't about evidence, it's much more about connection and community, there will be some signs that people can go, wow, I think that something really is happening here, even if it's not reported on the news. I want to go back a little bit because, you know, did you have any idea when you set out to write the Diet for a Small Planet book, how much influence it would have, and what was it that spurred you to go do that?
Well, absolutely not. I thought it would appeal to 500 people, maybe, in the greater Bay Area, as I wrote this little typed-up booklet. But no, I had no idea that my quest would cross, so to speak, would connect with the cultural quest for answers and people to feel part of solutions. I was just a kid in the library asking the basic question. I thought if I could understand why people go hungry, that would give me the key to the complexity of economic and politics, and I'd know how to orient my life. So I just sat there literally with my dad's slide rule, if anybody knows what that is now, and I put two and two together, and I said, wait a minute, the experts are wrong. They're wrong. There's more than enough food for all of us. And that was the biggest shock, because the way it changed my life forever is that it taught me that we see the world through the culturally determined filter, what I call mental map, and we can't see what doesn't fit in that. And so the experts were telling us that famine was inevitable because of lack of food, and they didn't go back and look at the square one question, is there enough? And so that's what I did. So I think quick answer is no, I had no idea the impact it would have, but it had the biggest impact on me because it kept me asking that, what is the fault frame? And that is the key question I have now, and I'd love to talk more about the false frame about hope, about power, about democracy, that limits us, that makes us feel powerless. And that is the core question. How do we break free from these myths that keep us feeling powerless?
Yes, I really like that idea. And of course, we have the scarcity as scare city. You know, it's the fear that there's not enough. And when life is abundance, we can get up off our buns and move our assets and start dancing together.
I love that. Do I have to quote you if I say that?
Oh, you know what? We're going to put that in. I get a lot of kidding from my friend Caroline Casey, who always cites me when she quotes me and all that. And then after a while, somebody's, have we now run past the statute of limitations? Can I now take? So, yeah, you can go ahead and use these. That's the whole idea of coining words and ideas is reframing. So speaking of reframing, go ahead and begin with us to reframe this idea of hope, which may have gotten a bad rap.
Indeed, I am a hope monger, and the reason that that is a badge of honor is that I do not ascribe to the idea that hope is for weaklings who can't face the hard news. I think the opposite, that hope requires courage, and it requires a kind of boldness that I of taking action. Because anyway, let me go back to the idea of hope. That, you know, we think of hope as kind of blind optimism, but I think of hope as work, as the good, good work of digging deeply to understand the nature. I'm going to make a big claim here, but the nature of reality, that what is it? It is everything is in constant motion. Everything is changing moment to moment, all in relationship to everything else. As my friend, the late Hans Peter Durer told me, Frankie, in biological systems, there are no parts, there are only participants. So if we absorb Hans Peter's wisdom, we're all participants, everything is changing moment to moment, we know that, then it is not possible to know what's possible. And that is the most freeing thought of my life, because if we don't know, then of course our actions could be those that change the world. We'll never know the ripples, because I argue that someone is always watching everything we do or don't do. And so the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, that every action or inaction affects all around us. And so that's what keeps me going, is this idea of it's not possible to know what's possible, and therein lies my freedom. And that worldview is not based on just Frankie's wishfulness. It's really science-based.
You know, this is really interesting, because if you look at many great projects, before I knew I couldn't do it, my first project in Washington, D.C. as a young teacher was starting my own alternative high school. And we ended up with with great success, with a book published by Simon & Schuster, with articles in the Washington Star and all of that. And the only reason why we did it was because we didn't know we couldn't do it.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And because if we had sat and listened to people telling us we couldn't do it, we'd realize that, well, you know, you're right. You people with more experience, you're right. So I think that at a time when many, many, many things feel impossible, the idea that it's not possible to know what's possible is it's an opening to all kinds of possibilities. So continue, say more. How has this showed up in your life?
Well, let me go back to 18 years ago. My daughter, this is one of the greatest blessings ever. Can you imagine traveling the world with your grown daughter, who, by the way, was exactly the age that I was when I wrote Diet for Small Planet? And Anna and I traveled on 5 continents looking for people who we later became to describe as pushing forward the edge of hope for all the rest of us to join in. And so among the people we interviewed, for example, is Wangari Maathai. We got to know her and stayed with her. And Wangari, oh my gosh, this Kenyan woman who later won the Nobel Peace Prize, she was beaten more than once. She's humiliated in the press. She faced the most incredible obstacles. For what? For planting trees. She began the Green Belt Movement with 7 trees on Earth Day in the 1970s. And those then, by the time Anna and I visit her, with this movement of women throughout the country, 20 million trees had been planted. Then, when she became a Nobel laureate for the Peace Prize, she got international attention. She teamed up with the United Nations Development Program. And recently, when I looked at what they have accomplished through an international effort, it is something in the order of, 15 billion trees? It was something in that category. I mean, from 7 trees to billions of trees. And, you know, she would never have predicted any of that. And so Wangari, whenever I think of my lodestar of courage, it is she. It is Wangari Maathai. And her, just as she put it, I just put one foot in front of the other. She just have to keep walking, she said. And then she smiled and said, but sometimes you have to jump. So I love that. So you just have to take that leap sometimes. But the point is that when I think of it's not possible to know what's possible, that's one great story.
Okay, we'll be back with Frances Frankie Morlepe in just a few minutes after this break. Steve Behrman with WikiPolitiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
Hi, this is recording artist and composer Yuval Ron, inviting you to a voyage through the chakras, a new double album of guided meditations to transform your life, a sublime musical medicine for nourishing inner peace and reaching to your higher virtues. Get it now at metamindfulnessmusic.com, M-E-T-T-A, mindfulnessmusic.com.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor, Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, hi, Steve Behrman. We're back with Francis Moore LePay talking about hope, a new definition of hope. And we just talked about how in actually seeing the example of people who've been humiliated and yet persisted. You know, humility and humiliation are related. They're also related linguistically to humor and humus. So sometimes when we voluntarily take on humility through humor, we can avoid the humiliation of having it imposed upon us. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
So let's continue with this. Let's continue with that. That's a very heartening idea, because so many of the people who have made these huge contributions, and hers was enough to, you know, get the Nobel Peace Prize, have had to endure tremendous obstacles, including people telling them, no, you can't. So,
right.
So let's continue with this idea of hope, and also with this bold humility. I really love that phrase.
Yeah, can I try to be a bit briefer than I was before with Wangari, but mention another inspiration for me right at this very moment?
Sure.
That I think a lot of Americans don't know about. What citizens can do, organized citizens. An organization called Corporate Accountability that's now decades old, and they've carried out many great initiatives. But right now, they are my heroes in big time. They helped organize and succeed in passing the first international treaty on tobacco to bring the tobacco industry, which was finding its sales decreasing in the industrial countries, that then set out to hook poor people on smoking, and citizens stepped up, and it was the first sort of citizen initiated public health treaty, or the first public health treaty of 2005. And now, you know, they are now just having a meeting in which they're developing tools to force tobacco companies to pay for the health costs of this terrible blight of tobacco addiction, and also stronger tools to limit the advertising. So there's another example of citizens coming together worldwide, led by Corporate Accountability, and succeeding, of course, not to the extent one can yet hope, but nonetheless, saving millions of lives. So I just think I want to celebrate that today, as it's still going on, this treaty conference. But there's so many of these untold stories that I just want to share. So you asked me about... remind me of what your question was.
Oh, it's bold humility.
Bold humility. Yeah. Okay. So the bold part is rethinking fear. And I want to get into that with you. I'd love to. But the humility part is the idea of being humble about it's not possible to know it's possible. That in a way it's kind of hubristic. It's kind of immodest to say that we can predict the future. So I like to call... this spirit of it's not possible to know what's possible is the humility piece. The bold piece is a big claim that Adam and I make at the end of our book together, Adam Eichen, and our book Daring Democracy, and that is that in the era that we happen to be alive on this precious earth, that the opposite of goodness is no longer, the opposite of evil is no longer simply goodness.
I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created
that being nice to each other is not good enough. What's required is a kind of boldness by rethinking fear as not something to fear, which I always did. I was afraid that I would be afraid, rather thinking about fear as a source of energy. And that also goes back to a story that was gifted to us by Wangari Maathai when one of her friends came to visit us and meet us and tell us about his life. And that's a longer story, but his message was that we can take the energy of fear, even life-threatening fear, and harness it. And he said, harness it and harmonize it as pure energy for us to use for good in the world. And that was life-changing for Anna and me, that sense that we had that power. I wrote a little book about this idea called You Have the Power, Choosing Courage in a Culture of Fear, with another intergenerational book, Jeffrey Perkins. But nonetheless, it was this very basic idea that fear is energy we can work with. And I have a little cheesy gimmick that I will share.
That's okay. We cheese around here. That's fine.
Okay. Well, I was in this awkward situation some time ago where all my friends were thinking one thing and I knew I was a little bit out of step, but I had to speak out and my heart started pounding and I started saying what I usually would say to myself, you wimp, Frankie, you wimp, you know, why is your heart pounding? And then in that moment I said, oh, that's just, that's my heart pounding with the energy of fear, and it's cheering me on. It's saying, go, Frankie, you know, stand up and speak. And so that idea of reframing the pounding heart as inner applause became something very helpful.
I love that idea. And it's funny that very recently somebody, I heard somebody speaking, I can't remember who it was, who said that fear and excitement show up exactly the same physiologically.
Yeah.
So when you are feeling fearful, let's say about a new experience, something that you're about to embark upon, and you feel you're feeling fearful, it might just be excitement. And so if you can get into the excitement of that rather than the fear, emotion is energy in motion. So regardless of what we label it, we can take that energy and shift it somewhere else. You were going to tell a story, though, about fear becoming a source of energy. You said it was a longer story. Maybe we can – there's plenty of time to tell it if it's going to spark inspiration in people.
Well, it's pretty dramatic. The story that was told to us in Kenya by – Wangari's friend, his name is Reverend Timothy Nanjoya, and he was invited over, as I said, you know, to introduce himself to us, and he began to tell his life story. And imagine this gentleman, a slight man in a bright blue shirt with a crisp white collar, a kind of priest collar, and Reverend Nanjoya began to describe how when he preached a sermon that was critical of the then dictator, Moy, that he was sent a warning by the dictator that if he preached again with critical words or even implied criticism, that he would be killed. But Reverend Nanjoya did not shut up. And so he continued in the same vein. And that night, swordsmen came to his door and forced their way in and began to slaughter him, really. And as he was lying on the floor, you know, with his, you know, just split open with the sword, he told us he was giving away his gifts. He was giving away his favorite Bible. He was giving away his library to his assailants. And at that point, my heart was pounding so hard, I had to interrupt him. And I said, excuse me, but Reverend Nanjoya, fear is an automatic response. How can a human being who's threatened like you were, how can you possibly be benevolent? And that's when he then stood up and he acted out this. He said, think of the lion that sees a prey, or, you know, the prey that could be a threat. And it doesn't just jump. It recoils. It recoils and harmonizes its energies, and then it leaps. And we can do the same with our fear energy. We can.
Wow.
Yeah. And so Anna and I lay awake in our bunk beds many hours talking about what would it mean if we really had that in our inner inner selves, that we carry that view. And I think she has, and that's what we try to do. You know, when I mean, this is, doesn't compare to anything that he went through or what Gary went through, but, you know, a commitment to walk over 100 miles. My biggest fear for the Democracy Spring March for Democracy was that I would be humiliated by being the lady who couldn't make it, you know, and have to be picked up in a car, and I would feel so humiliated, which was nothing compared to what they went through. But still, you know, it's that word again, humiliation. So, you know, when I was then sitting on the steps of the Capitol chanting, "Who is democracy? Our democracy," it was one of those moments where I felt like I could use my fear energy to get me all the way from Philly to D.C. So it worked.
Well, I think that's where the boldness comes in, that when you recognize that it's energy that can be tapped, then that allows for bold action, because you've awakened from how you've been pushed into one emotion, pushed into fear,
exactly,
by how we anticipate these things happening. You know, we're in the new word to describe our current politics, the situation that we're in right now. Do you think, I mean, I don't want this to be like, well, let's rationalize the horrific stuff that's going on, but do you think that in a certain regard, the shock of the Trump presidency can be a positive thing to mobilize people who were kind of sleeping before?
Actually doing that. And at one level, what I think can contribute to is awakening to the deeper roots. You know, often we hear people say now, well, this is happening because of the anger of people who've been disenfranchised economically and politically, and they don't see an avenue other than just, you know, tear it down. And that's what Trump promised. Of course, he's strengthening his policies, are strengthening the elite control of our economic and political system. But I think that it's still very possible, and I do see it in some people, that is an awakening to how deeply flawed the myths of our economic and political system, how deeply we have been trapped in the myth, you know, that I sometimes think of it as the myth that we're trapped in two myths. One, that the free market itself is magical, and if we just let it sort out outcomes, that then that's the ultimate fairness and all we can hope for. Or the other myth that, oh, well, you know, that all we can do is just work for some kind of redistribution after the fact, because we can't do anything about the concentration of wealth that I call the one rule economy, where basically everything is governed by the rule of highest return to existing wealth. And so we end up with the top 10% receiving 83% of all the income gains since the Great Recession. So, and I think that I heard somebody say recently, he who tells the story rules the world. And so mm-hmm. what I, and I sense that you are contributing to, and so many are contributing to, is trying to create a new story for ourselves that is not either the old charity, you know, let's redistribute, or let's just forget about any attempt at fairness and let the market rule. And the new story is, I think, about real democracy and real freedom, in which it's not just redistribution after the fact, but there is fair and inclusive opportunity for wealth creation to begin with. That people are fairly paid, and one has fair opportunity for benefits for retirement and all the things that allow us to participate fairly in the creation of wealth, not just, you know, after the fact wanting some crumbs to survive with. So we need new language and new understanding of how a truly democratic economy can work. And on that theme, I'm really focused on what I call dignity is being the key foundation of democracy.
You know, speaking of dignity, I mean, we're at a point right now where many people who don't have the community resources that we are fortunate enough to have are falling between the cracks. And if you can imagine somebody who is already marginal, their car breaks down, they don't have the money to repair their car, they can't go to their job, they lose their job, they can't repair their car, they don't have a job, they lose their home, and then all of a sudden they're marginalized. And I think that we have two political parties. I'm going to be very blunt. We have the abuser party and the enabler party. And, you know, the abuser party is heartless. There's heartlessness, and they justify their heartlessness by misusing Darwin and so on. And then we have the other party, as you had suggested, that they're looking to soften the impact of exploitive capitalism without really helping to change the rules of the game. So what do you see as the trims have, as perhaps a key? Of course, we don't know, but what you suspect might be a key to really turning this around and really creating a truly just economic system that's in harmony with the web of life.
Well, my emphasis has been a great deal on the building the democracy movement, meaning that people coming together, and this is really a transpartisan movement to some extent, you know, because we're focused on the right to vote and the vote without obstacles and hassles and things that are difficult for people who are working two jobs and don't have transportation. So ease in voting, like automatic voter registration, and mail-in voting and same-day registration and all of that, all of the ranked choice voting, many initiatives that are underway now in this democracy movement, releasing people who have paid their dues to society after committing a felon, releasing them from that additional barrier of being denied the right to vote. And Florida is a major case in point right now where there's an initiative to restore the right to vote to people who've serve their sentences. So all of that to me is so thrilling, and thrilling because people are working with others. And I think the way we increase our courage is together, that if we want to become bolder, look for people bolder than we and hang out with them, because we'll become them. You know, we absorb each other. And so I recommend, you know, our smallplanet.org has a lot about the democracy movement, but I'm trying to help create a real hub for the movement. Right now it's called Field Guide to Democracy is the website, and it's still incomplete in terms of the vast scope of our movement, but you definitely would get some sense of Field Guide to Democracy. I'm seeking to greatly improve that, if any listener wants to help out on that, so that anybody who hears, oh, democracy movement, what's that? They could go and get so excited about the initiatives. For example, how many Americans know that Seattle citizens came up with this great solution about fairness in real democracy in electing their city officials? So every voter gets democracy vouchers, $25, four vouchers of $25 that they then can give to whoever they choose for that race for their city offices. And so homeless people can vote, anyone can vote with their dollars, their democracy dollars, democracy vouchers. And it's been a great success. And now a couple of other cities, Albuquerque and Austin, are thinking of trying it. And most of us never heard of that, right? Go ahead.
We're going to take a quick break, Frankie, and we'll be back to talk more about this and even talk about Gandhi. This is Steve Behrman on Wiki Politiki Radio.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Hi, this is New Age Grammy winner Paul Avgerinos. Thanks for listening to Om Times Radio, and please support my peaceful healing music with a purchase at iTunes, Amazon, or wherever you shop for fine music. Just put my name into the search engine, Paul Avgerinos. A, V like Victor, G like George, E-R-I-N-O-S. You can also visit me at roundskymusic.com. Thanks for listening, and I'm wishing you the brightest of blessings.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Well, this is Steve Behrman. I'm back with our final segment. It's gone very quickly with Francis Moore LePay. I want to just highlight, can I highlight on the radio with a yellow underliner, something that you said in the last segment, and that was, if we want to increase our courage, we want to look for people who are bolder than we are. And I think that's really a key. Continue with that line of ideas. What do you find most encouraging right now at a time when a lot of people have given up hope? I think we traveled around the country and a lot of people are just kind of feeling very disheartened and not able to use the energy that they have.
Well, I definitely feed myself every day on others' courage that tells me, wait a minute, if they can do this, then how can I possibly give up in the least? I think I mentioned already what inspires me so much is what's happening in Florida. It's a campaign called Second Chances. And this campaign was started by a gentleman who himself was convicted of a crime and served his sentence, and he came out and he became an attorney, and a very distinguished attorney, and he still could not vote. And so he started this Second Chances campaign to change the Constitution in Florida. They had to collect over 700,000 signatures, and now they have to pass a ballot measure to change the Constitution, November 6th, they have to get 60% in favor, right? And right now it's looking very good. But can you imagine this man coming out of prison, unable to vote, and then proceeding to say, wait a minute, I can get a degree in law, and did.
Yes.
And then, I can work to change this law. And so I'm, and if anybody's interested, they're still looking for people to make phone calls, which I've done. to voters, Second Chances. It's called Florida, Second Chances Florida. So that's one campaign that just touches my heart at a very deep level. Because
and we did hear him at the UNRIG conference, didn't we? He was at the UNRIG the System conference. I was totally moved by what he said.
Yes.
Great example.
So, you know, that's what, but it is, you know, I have to say for me, you know, picking up the phone to call strangers in Florida as I did, you know, it wasn't scary, but, you know, just being, showing up, that was a chance to show up. It wasn't anything great, but to do that. So I think this is what Anna and I learned as we traveled the world and in India and Brazil and in Kenya and other places we traveled, that people working together, and we came home and we said to each other, wait a minute, these people face much greater obstacles than we do here in the United States. You know, and sometimes death threats and just terrible physical deprivation, but they were the most hopeful people we'd ever met. And that's when we came up with this slogan to ourselves and in our organization, that hope is what we become in action together, because that's what was different about them, that they were actually in action together. So anyone listening who doesn't feel that camaraderie, I really encourage you to look around and find others who are out there in action, and even one buddy, you know, one buddy that will encourage you to do what you thought you could not do. In any way, you know, leadership in going door to door for something you believe in, or just sharing with friends a perspective about something in your community or the nation. That is the essence of it, doing what we thought we could not do.
You know, something that you said, it might have been at the conference we were at in Dubrovnik, Croatia years ago. I can't remember where I heard it, but I attribute it to you. That's totally impacted me is the notion of the Gandhi moment, is when Gandhi realized that the people of India at that time, the time of his campaign, outnumbered the British colonials, I'm going to say, by a factor of 300,000 to one, really put things in perspective, even though the Brits had the, you know, overwhelming force and influence. I do remember you said that. In what book was that, so that I can find it again?
Oh, God, I don't remember.
Oh!
I don't remember which book. But that's exactly it, that we are trapped by the story we're told. I really believe that we accept our powerlessness because of the story we're told that that's just the way it is. And so for so much of what I am trying to do is really, as I said, you know, create a new story in which people realize that everything that is now so destructive to our country and our planet is kept in place because of our feeling of powerlessness, primarily. Yeah. I mean, because that's beautiful. I'm so glad you reminded me of that. I'm going to start using that again, because there is such a great example. But it's true here, too, that, you know, we, Adam and I, in our book, Daring Democracy, we point out that we are not as polarized as most of us think, that actually more than 80% believe that there's too much money controlling our political system. The majority of us want government to do more to fight climate change. On and on, you know, the things that we care most about as progressives, I'll just use that term, I don't know the best term, but solution seekers, that the majority of Americans agree with us. And so that, to me, is so empowering, that what they may not be in action together, but there's tremendous agreement around the problem of our democracy being in the grip of private wealth because of this false view of democracy as simply, you know, not really something that we live every day, something that we create together, and that we've given over our power to the powerful, who are the funders of our political system. So I think that that really is such a key breakthrough for me, is that our silence is what maintains the system, and that most of us, emphasizing that most Americans agree with the values that you and I are talking about.
Which brings us to the question, how do we bring people together beyond this divide? I mean, right now, it's a very, very polarizing conversation that's taken the air out of the room for any other kinds of conversations. I mean, you know, somebody pointed out yesterday at an event I went to, you know, Donald Trump being a polarizing figure almost causes you to take sides. You know, in other words, you're either with him or against him, and it's such a big issue that it's really hard to sidestep. And yet, I know the people, there are many, 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 many people who voted for Donald Trump who would readily agree with what you just said. There's too much money in politics.
Exactly.
The elites have too much power, et cetera, et cetera. What signs do you see, and what organizations and what projects, perhaps, do you see as a hopeful sign for bringing people together to a transpartisan movement to end the partisan trans?
Well, one website, one key in this movement is Democracy Initiative, which represents about 70 organizations representing 40 million Americans. It's Unite for Democracy, Democracy Initiative, I guess, .org. Their Twitter handle is Unite for Democracy. So I really recommend Democracy Initiative to see a lot of the initiatives underway. But, you know, I mentioned the kinds of reforms, specifically, say, Seattle, but there are, you know, you think of reforms such as matching funds for candidates to receive to run with public money, like Connecticut, Maine, Arizona to some extent. That is so hopeful that, for example, Connecticut, that there this public financing of elections has allowed progress to be made, you know, on a whole range of issues that probably wouldn't have otherwise made the same. So I think taking heart from the improvements in voting systems, their campaigns in so many states for automatic voter registration that increases the voter turnout among the people most hurt by our current economic and political system, and same-day registration, those that I mentioned earlier. You can read about those on Democracy Initiative and fieldguidetodemocracy.org. I couldn't begin to do this movement justice, but this is the canopy of hope, that metaphor I got from Wangari. The canopy of hope of people who are working on different pieces, but see themselves as moving together. You know, those working on campaign finance reform on the one hand, like I mentioned, Seattle, or others working on making easier for people to vote, and those working on ensuring that our voices have equal weight. There's an organization called Equal Citizens. I also recommend that because they're suing four states for having to do with the Electoral College, not giving representation to such a huge portion of the population, because all the votes are going to one candidate. And I want to point out here that I just learned that the depth of the Electoral College problem is that there, you know, any number of the people that have been, you know, pushing this on the Supreme Court, for example, were themselves appointed by President Trump and the first Bush, that did not receive the majority of the popular vote. And so really dealing with that issue of I think we can say we don't need a constitutional amendment to work around it, but ways we can ensure that the popular vote is decisive. So there's so many efforts underway, and that's what keeps me excited.
You know, and I think that what wants to be happening, and I could feel it, we could feel it at the UNRIG conference, is that there wants to be a movement of movements that allows us to overgrow the system and begin to entertain new possibilities like you're talking about that simply don't get talked about. I mean, even when Obama became president, he took the single-payer health issue off the table. I think even now it's obvious a majority of Americans would want to see that. So in a way, I think we have to – we don't need a new third party. I think perhaps we need a new first party that might be fashioned right. out of any of the ones that we have right now, or it might be something mm-hmm. totally independent. I certainly appreciate, Frankie, your assessment of hope and so on. We're gonna when we put this up on the site, we're gonna have a number of the sites that you have cited, so that people can get involved more. Thank you so much for giving us courage and for giving us hope. Francis Moore-LePay, thank you so much for being a guest on WikiPolitiki.
My total delight. Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Steve Behrman, and saying have a great week.